Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
And my name is Kathleen McGowan. And today we're very excited to have a very good friend of ours, a fascinating and gifted woman, Scarlett Amaris, who is our neighbor in the beautiful Ariège region in France, in Montségur. Welcome, Scarlett.
Thank you.
Scarlett is a very multifaceted and gifted artist. She is a writer. She's a screenwriter. She is in the process of writing a novel about Montségur. But what first brought Scarlett to our attention and what put us into the same place where we became friends and now colleagues because we're working together on a number of projects is Scarlett's extraordinary determination to get to the truth and to get to the heart of the legends around Sacred France. So those of you who listen to this show regularly know that this is our very favorite subject. There is nothing I love more than talking about the infinite and fantastic mysteries that exist throughout the southwest of France. There is so much there. It is so ripe to be uncovered. There is so much on the surface that is bursting to get out in this part of France. There are so many mysteries, some of them very, very ancient. Of course, we talk about the Cathars a lot, and we're going to talk about them some more, but we're also going to talk about the things that happened pre-Cathar, the things that make this land so sacred and so ancient from the very, very beginning. And these are the elements that Scarlett has really been researching and going after. One of the things I love about Scarlett is she is one of these hands-on, in-the-field types. When she decided she wanted to know about this part of France, she moved there, dug in, and became part of that landscape. And there is no substitute for that kind of research. So that said, Scarlett, welcome. And what first brought you to this magical area of France?
I first came here 4.5 years ago. I came here with filmmaker Richard Stanley, and he was the first person who introduced me to Montségur. I had read about Montségur previously in a very dry Cathar book, but the name of it resounded with me. Do you know when you come across a word and that word just sticks in your memory because it's kind of like a clarion. It just, there's something about it that resonates. And I knew that I had to come here. I knew that no matter what, that I must visit this place. And the first time that I came here, it was like coming home. It really, there was a familiarity to it that I had never felt anywhere else. You know, I'm from California, and I love California because I was born there, but I didn't have that same sense of knowing that I had here.
And were you surprised? Were you surprised by it?
Yeah, I don't think that I was, but I was surprised by the adventure that I had here and the trip that we had was full of magical coincidences and dreams and it was amazing the way that the events would connect to each other. And it was almost like the past was replaying itself in some sort of way. At the time I knew a little bit about the Cathars. I knew a little bit about the history, but I also kind of intrinsically knew it when I was here. And then I would stumble across it, and I would stumble across other things, and one thing would lead to another, and the set of coincidences around it, I mean, just didn't make any sense.
So at what stage did you realize that this was no longer a temporary adventure, but instead this was a destiny, that this was a life path, that destiny had brought you here? And where was the big aha moment for you, or was there one?
Wow, you know what? I've never thought about an aha moment. The first time that I visited the castle, it was on a night on a full moon, and it was also a lunar eclipse. And I had a very, very, very strange experience, a very strange, powerful experience up there. And it kind of changed my life view. And when I went back to my other life in California, it just didn't seem to matter anymore. Like, you know, I kept dreaming of this place every single night. And then not only would I dream of it, but I would turn the TV on and there would be a documentary on. You know, it was like I could not escape the pull. You know, somewhere I fell down the rabbit hole. there was like no turning back from it. You know, and it's really funny because I tried to explain to friends and to other people that aren't here. And I think that whatever this place is here, you know, in the Ariage, is so special that it kind of sends out a beacon. And some people hear that call and are drawn and they cannot stay away. And once you're here, you don't want to go back. But if you don't hear that call or you haven't been here and experienced it, you can't understand it.
Well, I can certainly relate to that. I am in Los Angeles at the moment. You are blessedly in Montsegur, and I am definitely feeling the exile right now. Because, you know, I've been coming back and forth to this region for many, many years. But Montsegur and the area specifically has really, really sunk its claws into me and said, it is time for you to be here and to do this. And I think, you know, I think it's because there are still so many untold stories in that area. I mean, the Aude region and the region around Marne-le-Château, of course, gets all of the attention. And I think that there are so many people going there and that have been going there since the Holy But Holy Grail phenomena, since the Da Vinci Code. And even though Montsegur gets its share of visitors, there is so much more happening in that region that the average person misses. So for me, I feel like we're being called there because there are stories that are dying to get out. And I think that that's one of the things that brought you and I together, is that we both had that strong sense of we need to be there to tell the stories, and specifically the stories that relate to the women who have been so important in that region. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about how you first were inspired by the women, both physical and non-physical, who are such a part of the history and the tradition of that region. Where did you first discover the Esclarmonds and the Divine Feminine, and how did that unfold for you?
I actually discovered it through a writer called Morris Mogg. And Morris Mogg was my first introduction to the different Shadowlands of the castle. And, you know, kind of how you and I met over Loba, because I was so thrilled that you were writing about Loba. And Mogg was the first person to write about Loba and to write about the loveliest woman in the Languedoc, the she-wolf of Cabaret. And it was like, wow, now there's a woman. So that's why I had, you know, gone and researched some of the dossiers on her, because I wanted to know, you know, who the she-wolf of the Languedoc was. I mean, that's just, she was amazing. And it was the same thing with the Esclarmonds. You've got Esclarmonde de Foix, who was the high priestess of the Cathars. She was the older Esclarmonde who refortified Montsegur. She kind of saw what was coming down the pike with the Crusaders, and she knew that this would be the last refuge. She had a niece who was born out of wedlock, who was one of the defenders of the castle and who lit the night beacons, and she was very ferocious but also very beautiful. Not as much as known about her, but she was very, very courageous for her time. And then there was a third Esclarmonde who was the daughter of the man who owned the castle of Montsegur, who was the lord of the castle. And she was a parfait, even though she was a teenager. And there are some accounts that say that she was sick. Other accounts say that she was not. But, you know, regardless, she was about 14, 15 years old when she was put in the bonfires. So all these three different women all get conflated into the same Esclarmonde. And Esclarmonde means the light of the world. You know, this is the light of the world, the light of the faith. These women, the way that Mogg wrote about them is that they were avatars of the goddess, that they were from another tradition that was passed down to the Cathars. And that absolutely captivated me.
And that's something that you don't really read very often. I mean, anyone who listens to this show or who reads my writing knows that I'm fond of ranting about how wrong the academic history of Catharism is, and how the majority of what is academically accepted as who the Cathars were and what they believed comes from Inquisition records and is completely and totally false. But one of the things that you are doing that I love and am fascinated by is you are looking at the indigenous priestess and goddess culture that is so prevalent in that region that the Cathars would have essentially inherited. And, you know, we talk a lot about the divine feminine. I think what's happening in Catharism, for me, that makes it so rich is it is this incredible weaving together of these cultures, as if these primitive Christians were able to also incorporate and accept and become one with these ancient traditions, as you say, a much older priestess tradition that was devoted to the goddess. So that, for a lot of people, feels controversial, although when you're there in that place and you see how profound the temple spaces are, for example, in Montségur, how much evidence there is of the goddess throughout the Ariège, you realize that it makes so much sense.
Yeah. No, it definitely
have you. Does. Where are you with this?
Well, right now, what I've been doing is I'm very interested. I've been researching the different families that were the noble families that are big in the stories in the Cathar stories, like in the fall of Montségur. So you've got the de Mirepoix and the Perels and the de Foix. But what's interesting is when you break down their lineage, I mean, besides coming up from the Counts of Barcelona and most of them descend from the same family, which is the Bellison family. And the Bellison family comes from Bellesta. And they believe that they were descended directly from the moon goddess Belisama. So, you've obviously got, you know, these defenders, they call themselves the defenders of the faith, the sons and daughters of Belisama, you know, who believe they were descended from the moon goddess, are your Cathar defenders. They're the ones defending the faith, which I think shows that, yes, there was a priestess tradition that was extremely strong that came down, I think, through the Celtic lines. You know, they at the time, before the Albigensian Crusade, you had, like, kind of a golden time here where you had different mystery schools that all incorporated each other's teachings, and they all accept each other, and they kind of, you know, lived side by side. So I think you've got a lot of different traditions that were feeding and teaching each other.
Well, and we also...
Go ahead. No, I was just saying, I think there were a lot of elements. I think there were pagan elements, Gnostic Christian elements, and Kabbalistic elements. I mean, who knows what else, that were all influencing each other in this region at that time.
Well, and one of the euphemisms for the Cathars is the weavers. We see that over and over again. They were referred to as the weavers. We have the weavers' crosses. We have the weavers' monuments. We have these things that are related to Catharism, which always refer to the weavers. Now, that does have a divine feminine element to it, but I also believe that it's because they were able to weave the threads of these many teachings together into this incredible harmonious whole. To your point, that there were Kabbalists living in the area. There were Sufis in the area. There's so much happening. There are so many sacred traditions and secret traditions that lived in this gigantic melting pot that was Southwest France for so many hundreds of years. And I think Catharism kind of takes the best of all of those and weaves them together. But also, the other thing I wanted to point out is for those who have read my books, in the Book of Love, I talk about this tradition of Belisama in the Chartres region in northern France. So we see it not just in the Southwest, but we see it in other pockets around France, but always, always in the place where there is a major sacred temple to the goddess or the divine feminine or the wife of God, however you want to refer to her. I mean, the region around Chartres is called Labeauce, because of Belisama. That is where the name ultimately comes from. So again, we see this presence, this Black Madonna presence of this wisdom tradition throughout France. And it's really, really fascinating.
Chartres has its cathedral, but it's really a conical hill jumping out of the landscape, and that same impression you have in Montségur as well.
Yeah, you know, and looking at it, some of the old dossiers, it's been the good thing about being in the village is that I've been able to go into some of the houses and come across these dossiers that have never been translated before. I mean, a lot of them are handwritten. But there was one that was talking about even, you know, way, way before the Albigensian Crusade, how Montségur itself, in the previous temple that was up there, was sacred to the, like, the noble ladies. And that it was the noble ladies' gathering place. You know, this would have been way before the Albigensian Crusade. In taking a closer look at Ballesta, I've been trying to research Valles d'Amour because you have this Valley of Love. The Valley of Love, and the Valley of Love has the Black Madonna there. But in looking at the Black Madonna, she actually looks like is a very close representation of Dea Matrona, which is a Celtic deity. She's a Celtic goddess, and she's one of the threefold aspects of the goddess. So I'm always interested in the blending of these pagan traditions along with the Gnostic Christian ones. But I think that the pagan spirit is still very strong in this land, and not much has been disturbed in such a long time. That's what fascinates me.
Well, one of the places that you took me a week ago, actually, a little over a week ago, you took me to a place called Morenci. And this is one of the places that you talk about. I'm going to take a little time out here and tell people that we're going to post Scarlett's information on the Spirit Revolution website, where you can visit her website, scarlettamorous.com. And you'll see that Scarlett is currently, she's guiding people through the area. She is sharing her wisdom. And you can actually, when you visit the area, you can get Scarlett to be your tour guide, and she will take you to these places. And I'm telling you, it will be the best tour that you will ever have, because you will see places you will not see otherwise. But Scarlett has also written guidebooks of the area, small dossiers that tell you what the area is about. And for those of you who are fascinated in the subject, whether you go to France or not, you need to read these. They're so much fun to read. There's so much information in them that will really enhance your understanding of what's happening in this region of France and give you, you know, these layers in it. So we'll give you that information. But one of the places that Scarlett took me that I had never been is a place called Morenci. And I was so overwhelmed by the beauty of this place, by the absolute Celtic spirit of it. I mean, I lived in Ireland for years. I am a Celtic girl. I arrived at this place and I felt like I was in the heart of Celtica. I did not feel like I was in France. I felt like I was in the heart of some incredible ancient Celtic nation. Can you talk a little bit about Morenci, Scarlett, and what's going on there?
Yeah, I certainly will. Morenci is a very, very small hill that is opposite Montségur. An absolutely fascinating place. You know, it's a beautiful drive up a very winding road. And once you get to the top of it, there's a cross that stands at the crossroads. Originally, what was up there was a huge rock that had symbols carved all over it. And it's dated from the Bronze Age. And in the 1700s, the Catholic Church came in and they carved a cross out of it. But they left the face of Belenos on there, of the sun god, of the Celtic sun god. And he overlooks the crossroads in the whole valley. And beneath it is a figure eight that is on its side. That is, you know, it's two very thickly formed circles that, you know, I like to think is like two worlds touching or heaven and earth touching. Belenos looks across the crossroads over to these very big, what they call dolmens or mineros. The miner is called Dental Hero, and that's the one that you can climb up and sit in the chair and see the perfect view of Montségur. But what's interesting is there's only been one archaeologist who has really kind of dug the place, and he's found all these ritually buried bodies from the Bronze Age, which during that time, they generally burned the bodies. So these were very important people that were buried next to this miner, and they were buried with ornamental jade, and they were buried with jetstone and what was the other? Oh, and dog's teeth. And then supposedly, there's the necropolis that they found that goes down, and they also found, right next to Dental Hero, a sculpture of a hand. And it's called the Le Main de Morenci. And all of the fingertips are missing. They've all been cut. But if this sculpture, which is from the Bronze Age, would have been a person, this person would be over 2 meters tall. And it's carved out of soapstone. It's a very beautiful carving. The person who originally found it became frightened of it. He thought it was malorific, which is the word that he used. He thought that it was leprous. But it's a very, very interesting area. And as you wander around, there's also a huge stone in the forest called the Rock of Fugax. And the area is very interestingly terraced around there. Like, you could have had an audience standing around the stone. And there's a huge circular carving on top of the stone, which you can climb up on one side. And then it's got, like little basins for it to drain down the other side, which, looking at it, I mean, it could have been used agriculturally, but it really looks and feels like it was used ceremonially.
Well, one of the things that I was fascinated by when we were there was this chair, this sort of stone throne. We had to climb up this, you know, outcropping of rock. And when you get there, there is this, whether it is natural or not, I don't know. It appears to be natural, and yet it is such a perfect armchair. And it has the most extraordinary view of Montsegur. When you are sitting in this chair with your back to it, Montsegur is directly in front of you. And it feels devotional, and it feels intentional. What do you think?
No, I agree. In fact, it's like, I feel like I'm giving away my secret spot, but because that's, for me, when I need to become clear, you know, when I need to really focus on something, or I just need to be quiet for a while, that's where I love to go. And it does. It is very devotional. It is a perfect view of Montsegur. It is, I think that it's naturally made. I just think that it's an incredible spot.
I don't think you have to worry about giving away your secrets, because no one will find it without you. They have to go with you if they want to sit in this chair.
I'm just joking.
But, you know, I was thinking, you know, the area outside of Rennes-les-Bains, there's that, the quote, devil's armchair, or the seat of Isis, or whatever you want to call it. There is that stone throne that everyone runs up to Rennes-les-Bains and goes up to it because it's, you know, features in the Rennes-le-Château mysteries, and everyone sits in that chair. And it's kind of, for me, become like the Disneyland of the Languedoc. So I don't feel a lot of energy when I go to that place because it's very, very overrun. So for me to discover a place like this that has not yet become part of the circus and still holds this extraordinary power of devotion. I mean, when you sit there, you can feel, you know, the centuries or even millenniums of people who have sat there before in this place. And it really is extraordinary.
You know, when I first came to Morenci, the first thing I said when I got out of the car and stood there at the crossroads is I said, this was a place of celebration. This was a place of gathering. It's still so evident in the landscape. And yeah, sitting up there, it's devotional, but it's extremely majestic too.
Philip, you've done a lot about this idea of mountains of creation and conical hills and that kind of thing. How do you think that ties into everything we're seeing with Montsegur? And you mentioned about the connection between Montsegur and Chartres and how they're in high places. But you've talked a little bit privately with me about this idea of it being a spot of creation. I'd love if you could elaborate on that for a minute.
Well, I mean, every culture has places which it sees as places of creation. In Landscape of the Gods, I talk about Barrick Law, which is this conical volcanic crop which sits right at the back of North Barrick, and which was always seen to be linked with the creator goddess, the Calach, you know, the Carling in the more English rendition. And she is the one who has created the world. When you start looking at Barrick Law, it's this, you know, some call it a pyramid, but it really is a conical hill. And it's always identified as a navel, in some cases a breast of the goddess. And when we start looking into the archaeology, you will quite often find that there is very little to find early on. Because when you start looking into anthropology, you will find that an awful lot of cultures say, well, that's the hill of the gods. We're not supposed to be going there. Or if they did go on there, they only went to a certain level. It's very much like Mount Olympus, whereby they say, oh, you know, the top of Mount Olympus, is the Greek gods reside there. It's their domain. It's not for ours to go in there. And so you have that in many cultures. And I think this is also what we're seeing in Montsegur. I think early on, even though, you know, there's this big Cathar castle on top, I think early on most of the people would have had not really gone to the top of it. They would have stayed at a lower area. I think some of, you know, the closest place where people would really have gone to is probably where the modern day car park is, because that is very much a level where you see this gigantic conical outcrop that is Montsegur, really from the best point of view. And so again, when you start looking at, and I'll go back to Barraclough, what you see is that all around it, you're beginning to see standing stones, menhirs. There is intervisibility, for example, between Barraclough and Trepraylough, which is where in mythology it said that the king ruled from, where the Lothians come from. And so to find places like Moransee, where you actually find seats which are clearly designed for humans, and where you find that there are burials of clearly important individuals, it's beginning to make sense, because, again, Montsegur, even though within Cathar mythology, so to speak, is just a conical hill with a castle on top, within a more pagan environment and within a pagan history, it would be only one aspect of a far more elaborate and far more sacred landscape than just this one hill.
But we're also talking about the Celts here in so many cases. Barraclough, Scotland, Celtic traditions here in this part of France, very, very powerful. And this idea of mountains of creation in almost all cases is female. It is the navel of the goddess. They are the breasts of the goddess. These hills, as you say, not only in Scotland, but also in France, and Scarlett, you can jump in here too, are all, there is intervisibility. So, for example, you can see from one Cathar castle to the next, you know, if you are in the right angle on a clear day. I mean, isn't that correct?
Oh, of course, from Montsegur, you can see Roquefixade from one side, and from the other side, you can see, from the other side of the mountain, you can see Puyvert. And there's a lot of evidence that they lit night beacons as signals to each other to let, you know, to let them know that everything was okay. But yes, you can see them evidently. I was just going back thinking about something Philippe said, and it's true that where the car park is called the Place de l'Église, or the place of the church. And back in the 1920s, they found that that is where the original village was, that would have been the 13th century village. And there was an old church, and there was a blacksmith, and they found all this archaeological evidence. Unfortunately, most of that information is lost now. But next time that you guys are here, I have to take you into the Reboul, because the Reboul has these very obviously man-made hills that almost look like burrow downs, I think is the word, what they used to bury the people in. Mm-hmm. But and then they've got the little valleys in between with standing stones. They're absolutely magical, and they're completely wild and unknown. But it's evident from anybody that goes there has the same experience without telling them anything, that this place was important, that this place, you know, is absolutely magical, that there is something here that kind of speaks to everyone.
And when we're focusing on Montsegur Castle itself, you know, again, we are assuming within the normal piece of history that this was just a castle built for defensive purposes. But you've done an awful lot of research, including going up there very early on in the morning and spending nights there, tracking solar phenomena and basically showing that what we think is a fortress is really more what I would call a solar temple with solar alignments.
It does. It definitely has solar alignments. That is proven. But it also is aligned to the moon and the stars. It has, you know, different celestial alignments. Whoever built this castle, and that, you know, they can say that it was rebuilt, but nobody ever says what it was rebuilt from. The original builders who built the different alignments knew exactly what they were doing. I don't know if they used it to chart time, if they were, you know, using sidereal, what do they call it, sidereal geometry, but definitely it is aligned. At different points of the year, stand in one door and see Venus perfectly as the belt of Orion is straight overhead. I know where the full moon azimuth is, you know, during the summer solstice, and where it is during the winter solstice. The castle has solar phenomenon on both the winter solstice and the summer solstice. So yes, the original builders, absolutely, it was a celestial temple. There's no doubt.
What has surprised you the most in this process? I mean, what you've gone through a lot and you continue to uncover things. And I think for me, the surprise is that we've only scratched the surface. I mean, every step you take in the region, you discover something new and amazing. But does one thing really stand out for you? One thing that really makes you say, oh, the whole world needs to know about this, or I'm dying to talk about this?
You know, the one thing that I have been trying to track and have just started to put the pieces together is this white lady apparition. You know, the white ladies all the way up. And it seems like every church, every little church I go to and every little village has these white lady apparitions. I think a lot of them, they call them the Marian apparitions. Most of them are undocumented because I don't think they know what kind of name to give them. But, you know, each of these places generally has a healing font. It has some sort of healing associated to it. And these white lady apparitions that are fairly similar in nature all the way up the valley. It fascinates me. I think, I can't remember who told me recently that wherever there's white lady sightings, that's somewhere where, it had a high priestess, a priestess tradition. But these continue on, and there are so many of them, and it's completely undocumented. It absolutely blows my mind that nobody has taken this information and put it together and tried to figure out just what it is.
Well, I remember the first time I was in the Chateau of Puy-Laurens, and I was, you know, using the little map that they give you to walk around the ruins and that tells you where things are. And then I found a plaque that actually says, "This is the Chapel of the White Lady." And I thought, Wait a minute, there's a Chapelle of Dame Blanche right here, and nobody's talking about this. And they labeled it the Chapel of the White Lady.
I actually love the story of the White Lady of Poulon because you can only see her during the crescent moon in December. You know, and she's supposed to walk through the castle trailing her veils behind her, which I think is fantastic. Puyvert has a White Lady. Valles de Mor has four White Lady sightings. The newest one I've just found is Notre-Dame de Salle. Montségur, of course, has the White Lady. You know, that they call Esclamont. She's been cited numerous times. So yeah, it's very, very, very interesting.
And just to expand a bit, you mentioned the Marian apparitions. Lourdes, as such, is not that far. And whereas everybody always thinks that Bernadette saw the Virgin Mary and this was a one-off, there's a very strong local tradition that the cave in which Bernadette had her vision was actually a cave where many people before had seen white ladies appear. So it definitely shows that there is this very ancient tradition of seeing white ladies all around that region. Have you got any opinions or ideas as to what would trigger these phenomena? What are they? What is the white lady for you?
To me, based upon my personal experience and from what I have researched, I think in some places, I could explain it two ways. In some places, I think that the past and present here are very thin. They're very side by side. And I think that they bleed into each other sometimes. And in some way, either you're seeing something from the past or you've got these lines of energy that are so strong that given the right conditions, you're allowed to see something that you normally don't see on an everyday channel. And whether they come to give you a message, whether they come to, you know, be the forebringer of whatever, I think that there is a reason that the different people see them.
I think the veil is very thin in that region, definitely. And maybe this is why it becomes, you know, such a powerful place for these prophetesses. This is one of the things that I write about a lot, is that there was a very strong prophetess tradition in this part of France. And it's something that is still quite secretive and that people don't talk about very often. You'll see it, you know, it's one of those things that in the churches in the Southwest, and Scarlett and I are working on this together. We're working on a book about decoding the churches and having eyes to see when you go into these places and seeing what's really going on. And one of the things that you see over and over again, you see are images of St. Anne. St. Anne is very powerful in the traditional Christian perspective, but they also refer to her overall as Saint Anne the prophetess. And so what you see as you start seeing Saint Anne, these images of Saint Anne where she's always teaching a child, for example, it's usually depicted in traditional Catholicism as Saint Anne and the Virgin, right? It's her teaching her daughter to read. You see this over and over again. But what it really is, it's a metaphor for how powerful these traditions were in the women of the region and how there were prophetesses in this region, and how the girls were the real secret and treasure of the Cathars was their girls, that these extraordinary priestess traditions and cultures were passed down from the grandmother to the young child because the mothers were busy ruling the world, right? So we see over and over again that Anne represents this this Kylek, this crone, this wisdom tradition who's teaching the girls. And she is often shown in the heretical world with a white veil, which is known as the prophetess's veil. So when I think about these legends of white ladies trailing veils and white veils, I'm always thinking about this prophetess tradition. We recently discovered when we were allowed into the secret room in Notre Dame de Marseille, where they keep the real Black Madonna because the other one is a replica, because they have to protect her from thieves, that there are all these ex voto paintings in the secret room. There's about 15 paintings of women in the region over the course of several hundred years who had visions of this Notre Dame de Marseille. So we see even in the art, even in the church, now the church hides them. They're in a secret room and you have to have permission to get in there. You don't see them, you know, in public. But I actually posted a picture of one of them on my Facebook, and I'll get it up on my website because I actually think it's one of my ancestors. But it's a picture, a painting from the 1780s of a woman having a vision of Notre Dame de Marseille appearing to her. So we see this over and over again, that the women in this local area are having visions. A divine lady is appearing to them. And I absolutely think that when you look at Lourdes and you look at Bernadette being in a grotto having a vision, that we certainly see this throughout the Ariège. Can you talk about the grotto in the region a little bit, Scarlett?
Sure. It's funny, I was just having this conversation with Christian Koenig yesterday, but Montségur itself, it is supposedly riddled with grottos. Most of them have been covered up now. Most of your major grottos are in Ussat, which is interesting because the white lady in Ussat in the grottos supposedly snatches children. That's the only bad white lady stories that I know of. But, you know, we have the Grotte of Lambrives near here. Lambrives is great because the original excavators of Lambrives were
Dominicans.
Yes, yes. So, of course, they gave everything in Lambrives, like, these terrible names where it's like Satan Synagogue, and everywhere you go through there has got these demonic names. They just, they saw terrible things everywhere in there. So that, you know, I think they gave it a very negative connotation. Also in Ussat, you have the Grotte de Bethlehem. It has a solar phenomenon on December 25th, which is why it's called the Bethlehem Grotto. It's also got the initiatory altar in it, which is the pentagram that people climb into. And Antonin Gadal writes a lot about it as being very important to the Cathars, and that people, I think they use it now for the initiation into becoming a new man. So you stand in the cardinal points and then step down from it.
Well, do you feel that the caves in the area are related to this goddess tradition? Because I certainly do.
I believe so. I think if you look at a lot of the older goddess tradition, like when you look at Tribal and the, what do they call it? The Magna Mater, the mother of the mountains. That tradition is very strong here.
It just feels very womb of the goddess to me, you know, and that's what it feels like to me. It feels like we know that they're in the grottos throughout France and also in other traditions, that there was this initiatory experience of going within the womb and being reborn. And we also, Philip and I recently were studying this when we were in Brittany, because what we've got there is places where the grottos are not indigenous to the land, so they have reproduced them, right? That's where you have these cairns and these sites where, you know, that you go into an initiatory type temple and then you are reborn from the womb of the goddess as well. So for me, I think that what's happening in those caves in that region is very much about a womb of the goddess kind of initiatory experience. You know, in addition, in terms of Cathar history, we certainly know that the Cathars were hidden there and found refuge there during the persecution. So I think that it's all part and parcel to the mystery of the area. But what I was going to ask you about, too, is one of the things that you have taught me a lot about is this resurgence of Catharism that was happening in Montsegur at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, my research in Montsegur is very much about the medieval period and the Cathar period. But you have taught me a lot about the fact that there was so much happening. There have been these periods of sort of Cathar Renaissance, and I am excited to say that I believe we are in one of them right now. But prior to us, in the early part of the 20th century, around, you know, from the 30s on, there were some interesting things happening there. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Certainly. Yeah. Montsegur seems to go in waves, and in the 30s and in the 40s, you had different people. There was the Cathar resurgence where you had all these different characters researching different texts and coming together kind of in roundtable discussions. You had author Morris Mogg, who, you know, who they call the poet of the South. You had Finita de Perfu, who had a house up at the top of the village. Supposedly, she was a countess. You had the Countess de Puyol, de Puyol Murat. Otto Rahn was here. Supposedly, Steiner was here. René Nelly. All these very, very interesting people that had this unbelievable love and interest in Catharism. And they would get together. They would share their knowledge. Of course, after a while, you know, they fractured off into different groups, but there was so much happening at the time. I think you and I were discussing it because of the church, because that's when the church was redecorated. And when you go into the church in Montsegur, there's so much going on underneath the surface. And, you know, there's Masonic symbolism, there's ancient symbolism, there's Kabbalistic symbolism in the church. It's absolutely stunning when you start to unravel it. And that would have been the time that they had gone in and redecorated the church in Montsegur. So they left like little clues behind everywhere. But it was a Renaissance time, and the Albigensian Crusade and the Cathar faith was coming back into the popular consciousness. There were a lot of books written. You had Dia de Rocher here. And I think that lasted for about 20 years, and then it started to cool down again. And then there was another brief resurgence in the 70s, and then it started to cool down again. And then now it's amazing in the last, you know, couple of years, in the last year, that it's really like the mountain is calling again and saying, yes, yes, please tell the stories. Please get them out there. Yeah, there's a renaissance happening here. That is for sure.
And there's a writing renaissance happening, which I'm very excited about, and I'm very excited to be a part of. So let's transition a little bit and talk about how this has affected your writing. You're a very accomplished screenwriter. You're working on some incredibly exciting screenwriting projects right now. You have a very, very interesting and exciting film thing happening. What's happening in your world as a writer, Scarlett?
Right now, I'm getting ready to write an adaptation of The Color Out of Space by H.P. Lovecraft with Richard Stanley. I have been finishing up my dossiers, and then hopefully we will very soon start on writing The Light of the World.
And The Light of the World is your novel about one of the Eskrimons, right?
Yes. Actually, it will be three novels, and that will be the middle section.
Are you going to write about all three of them, or are you writing it as a trilogy because you're breaking down all three of their lives?
I'm actually breaking down three different times, three different time periods.
Fantastic. Yes. And you're going to be working with us on a new writer's initiative in Montsegur. Because one of the things that we are discovering is that there is no better place in the world to write. I mean, the inspiration that comes from being in this place is astonishing. How would you say that being in Montsegur inspires you and helps your writer's muse to flow? Because this is one of the things I'm trying to make people understand. You have to go to Montsegur as a writer. Go even just to visit, you know, whether you come with us or go on your own, just go, because it does something to you. It's its own special kind of muse, I think. And are you finding that? Do you feel that you write better or differently in Montsegur than anywhere else?
Always. I have always done my best work here, and just being able to go walk out in the forest and hear the owls call, and to be in touch with whatever it is that is so ancient that lives here, and be able to connect into that and to go into that space that I can't really find anywhere else in the world, that really helps me to write and to get the flow of it, and to visit these ancient spots and to really feel the trace of what was there before, and it becomes so alive. Yeah. You know, that's why I love this place, is because the past is never far away. It's always accessible. It's always there. The echoes of all these ancient cultures, you know, they still resound. They haven't been erased.
Well, and I think it's also one of the reasons why, you know, writers went there. I mean, even Kate Moss in her book Labyrinth, we interviewed her some years ago, and she basically said that the original idea of writing Labyrinth came to her while walking up Montsegur. So this tradition of the mountain inspiring people isn't just something which happened in the 1920s or happened, you know, in distant times with prophetic dreams or visions. It's something which is there and can be touched by basically anyone who climbs it. And, you know, Kathleen, Scarlett, and myself, we have led groups up Montsegur over the last few months as part of Sacred France. And I think it's fair to say that people are transformed and inspired, that this mountain speaks to you. I think it's you, Kathleen, who says that kind of like the mountain also has a way of guiding you to the top, of taking you, you know, giving you a landing hand and making you ascend it.
Yes, she helps you up. but also, you know, the Montsegur is where my books were born. I mean, my first inspiration for The Expected One came standing up at the top. You know, that's when I realized that there were certain things that I was absolutely going to have to change in my life and in my writing. And so Montsegur has continued to inspire me. It really is the reason that The Expected One and The Book of Love exist. And so I think that for all three of us, you know, we all became so excited by this idea of Montsegur as a place that has called writers for centuries and has been the home of a lot of extraordinary writing inspiration. And we all decided that we wanted to be a part of making that happen in a bigger way, which is why we created this idea of the Writer's Grail in Montsegur. So we will be doing some extraordinary workshops over the next year. We're doing our first workshops in 2012. We're definitely doing one during the week of the Montsegur commemoration on March 16th, where we're taking a small group, we're limiting it to 15 people, and we're doing a one-week intensive of exploring the important sites of Montsegur and then writing about them and finding other ways to utilize this inspiration in our writing. And I'm so excited about doing this. Anyone who's interested in finding out more about what we're doing there, the March one is almost full, but we're going to be adding some others. I think we're going to try to do one around the summer solstice. You can go to sacredfrance.com or thewritersgrail.com. And we'll also put it up on the Spirit Revolution. We'll talk more about that. But I think this idea of there being a writing revolution is exciting, and we're seeing it throughout the entire region of Cathar country. We have a friend who's creating something very special in Puivert. Puivert is the troubadour castle, and he's trying to create an art and music type of retreat center there. We're seeing a lot of artists coming to the region. We have friends who are piano players and harp players and pan flute players, and who are coming to the area and celebrating these traditions in music. And so I think it's time to celebrate it in writing again, and I'm very excited to be a part of it. And Scarlett, I absolutely believe that you are one of the leaders of this writing revolution in Montsegur.
I'm so excited about it, because from the people that we have had here, that we have taken to these places, it has always changed them. Whether they be artists, writers, whatever, they are always inspired, and I love seeing what they pick up on. I love seeing what comes from it. You know, I love seeing the stories or the artwork. It's amazing to me, the inspiration, and it happens to everyone. And yeah, to be able to give that experience, I'm astounded. I can't wait. I cannot wait to see what people come up with.
Well, I also think that part of the mission that we're being called to in Montsegur is to bring people there, and specifically to bring writers there who can tell these stories, because there are so many of them. I mean, you and I can't possibly tell all the stories of this region in our lifetime. There are so many stories to be told. There are so many aspects of the beauty and the history and the spirituality and the culture to be experienced here. And also the personal transformations that happen. I mean, over and over again, as we bring people to this region, we watch the transformation, and it's such a beautiful thing to observe. But each one of those people has their own story to tell about how this region has inspired them or has changed them. So I think that, you know, to be able to facilitate people to come into the area and experience it and be changed by it and then write about it and share it with other people is a very, very powerful thing and a very exciting thing to be a part of.
Definitely. Definitely. It touches everyone. Anyone that has come here, it has changed. And it doesn't leave either. That's the interesting thing, is that it will continue to reside and to resound, and whether people come back or not, but it will always stay with them.
And to some extent, ladies, you step into that priestess tradition, because you're the ones who are drawing people in and preparing them for this step of transformation, which is pretty much basically what the priestess tradition would have done in the past with places like Montsegur, correct?
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Philip. I love that. Yeah.
That was very Grail Knight of you, Philip. Thank you for honoring the divine feminine, both of us. You
My
know,
pleasure.
One of the things I want to say, too, is that we just came back from, we had a group there. We've been back for about a week. And, you know, one of the girls on our trip coined the term post-traumatic sacred France syndrome, because what's happened is everyone who has gone home is like they can't leave Brigadoon. Everyone is, even people who never in a million years thought that they would have this kind of experience, they can't get it out of their heads and their hearts and their spirits. And whether they're in New Zealand or Connecticut or California or St. Louis, they're all in this place of saying, how do we go home again? You know, because they're feeling something that was so very profound for them. And that's, you know, an amazing thing. And I think for a lot of people, specifically Americans, but not only, there is something that happens in France, especially this part of France, that opens them up in a way that you just can't experience in this country. In this country, I mean America, because that's where I am. But I think that there is something, there is a peace and there is a depth to the ancient traditions that speaks to Americans in a way that many of them have never, ever, ever seen before or felt before. And it's profoundly affecting them. And I think that that's all part of what's going forward now in this new era that we're about to enter into. So spiritually, Scarlett, how has this affected you and changed you? How do you feel that you have changed personally, emotionally, spiritually since coming in contact with these histories, stories, and this land?
You know, it has definitely, definitely changed me. I am more in touch now with the light and the dark of both the traditions. And it was interesting when I was back in LA recently and I hadn't been back for a couple of years, the first thing I said was, this, it's great for all the convenience, but my soul does not reside here anymore. You know, my soul resides in Montsegur, and everybody kept saying, you know, there's something different about you now. There's something different about you. I can't quite put my finger on it, but, you know, I know what it's like to be close to the land. I know what it's like to spend the night with the full moon. I know what it's like to, you know, come across these things that are so old, and that's what's important to me is finding out more about the study, the stories, and you know, being close to this ancient nature that I think is so intrinsically lost in our modern life. And once you learn that energy and you learn how to plug into it and it becomes a part of you, you never want to let it go.
And that is indeed, I think, you know, the power and the transformational effect of bringing a spirit revolution out in yourself. Unfortunately, we have reached the end once again of this week's episode of The Spirit Revolution. So, Scarlett, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
If you want to hear Scarlett again, you can do so in a number of ways. If you want to hear any of our previous editions of The Spirit Revolution again, you can do so in the same manner, which is bbsradio.com, where you will have archives. However, you will need to pay for them, and you will not just get access to us, but to all the other BBS radio shows. You can download for free this and so many other episodes of The Spirit Revolution from iTunes. And 5 last episodes, the most recent ones, are always available on our own very website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. Until next time, however, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.